I think Joe or Troy could probably help you. What platform is Vinny connected, Joe? Yeah, folks, this is live radio, and then
He's connected to Troy.
we're just kind of bearing everything out here.
Well, see, regardless, I'm a radio show host that always ensures that I have a double backup system going. So if I'm not recording the live stream in the next room on my other Mac, I'm recording the stream across the Skype here with my video as well as all your guys' audio and everything as well. So regardless of not, that'll work. So allow me to introduce myself. And by the way, by the way,
go ahead.
Hagman and Hagman, my God, the dudes, as it were.
Now, what makes you say that, Vinny?
Well, namely because you're the very first clique of radio show hosts to ever allow me a full 3 hours before. I've been in activism for, I think this is coming on my 5th year now, and my show is 2 hours a day, 5 days a week on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, and I've done maybe over 100 appearances on other radio shows, none of this size, none of this scope, and none of the of them have been, well, basically based upon your guys' world, which is the very Christian and intelligence community based radio. So it's quite an honor and an esteemed pleasure, gentlemen, in light of just who you are with your well, basically your rap sheets, as it were. In exposing scumbaggery and the prominence that you have, and my producer tells me that you're one of the top shows on Blog Talk Radio, and I've been on, I don't know, maybe 20 to 30 different Blog Talk Radio shows with hosts of numerous different types and persuasions, but I seem to get along with everybody because I think we're all facing the same problem. We're all walking the same shoes, and it's a jackboot, more or less.
So
the only argument that I can really ever have with anybody is if they indeed are planning to bust down my door wearing a black uniform and try to exterminate me. And to this date, I've not met a truther who is planning on doing that at any point. So naturally, there's fundamentally no real argument that we can have, because those are the lines in the sand that are drawn, essentially. Do you want to kill and harass and befuddle innocent individuals? None of us do. Some of us.
No, of course not.
Yeah. Some of us do, on the other hand.
well, and a lot of those are well, you know, we'll talk about who those people are here shortly, but I think a proper introduction to our listening audience is indeed imperative, Mr. Eastwood. First of all, ladies and gentlemen, we have as our very special guest tonight, if you go to HomelandSecurityUS.com, on the top of our page, you will find our announcement of Mr. Eastwood, the host of Vinny Eastwood's show from New Zealand, and he's also on American Freedom Radio. We have links to, Vinny, we've got links to your radio show. We've got links to your YouTube channel. And I don't know if there's any other links that you want to provide in this introduction, but I'll give you that opportunity. We'll give you that opportunity. But I've got to say, ladies and gentlemen, this man, this young man, has been in radio for 5 years, roughly, give or take.
Well, not in radio for five years, but in the new media for 5 years. I started out on the street with a camera.
And I've got to tell you, he's just like us in the sense that all we want is the truth. All this man wants is the truth. And although he's younger than we are, certainly me, I think you're probably about the same age as my son, but I've got to tell you, you have just a tremendous amount of knowledge. You're articulate. and you're a pleasure to listen to. And folks, I would urge everyone to tune in to Mr. Eastwood's show.
And he does have a website here, Guerrilla Media, www.guerrillamedia.co.nz.
So,
as he's from New Zealand.
Fill in the blanks, Vinny, for us. What have we missed here in your background that you want to share or you feel is relevant here?
Well, you know, I've got a long and interesting backstory. You know how if you're working every single day at something, after only a few years, you wind up having a massive back catalogue of work that basically nobody's even capable of catching up on because there's too much of it? That's me. I'm always out there raising the holy hell. So let me just kind of I've got this saying: in the end, everything comes back to the beginning. When I was 19, I had repeated a year, my final year of high school, because my first final year of high school, I spent most of the time trying to be popular and drink with other people and what have you. And I wound up with bad grades. And at the end of the day, now that I've moved away from high school and not associating with those people anymore, no friends from that era have actually made it through into the current day. Not a single person that I was once friends with in any high school or any job am I still friends with to the day. Why? I don't know. But maybe my experience will kind of shed some light on this. My first job, I actually injured my wrist, so I wasn't able to go and do some work. I was trying to bench press something that was a little too heavy for me, and I busted my wrist. So instead of going out and getting gainful employment, because I'm kind of physically unable to, I instead wrote a play, produced it, directed it in order to finance my trip to university. After my second year of high school, I was actually incidentally friends with basically the 14 top young actors on Waiheke Island, where I went to school. And we put on this play. It was very well received. I made people in the audience cry, which I think is basically the pinnacle for any artist, is to produce an emotion so strong as to have a physical reaction from the audience. So I got that money. I went all the way down to Dunedin, same southern city in New Zealand, and I began to subject myself to a lot of harsh realities there. Let me see. Like, the way I can encapsulate this, how cold it was, and how crappy the house was. I saw my olive oil in the kitchen freeze at room temperature.
Okay, that's
all right. We were complaining about the mold on the ceiling of the bathroom. It's just completely covered with black mold, and the landlord lived across the street, and so we asked him, you know, to come over and check out this mold problem. We really want a dehumidifier to take some of the humidity out of the air, so this mold problem would stop getting worse. And so sure enough, he comes over about 5 months later, comes across the road, and he says, "Oh, you guys are just city slickers, you know, you don't have to deal with any of this, you know, you're just complaining." And so look, it's fine, and he rips this big chunk of paint off of the wall, and behind it is nothing but this black Mercer mold, the worst kind of thing that you'd see in an alien movie or something of that, is kind of the closest thing to cinematic history that I can liken it to. And so suddenly he realizes what's going on here, and he goes, oh, okay, I'll get you a dryer. So he buys us a tumble dryer, and each room of the house is massive, you know, like a 7-8 foot clearance in the ceilings, impossible to heat. We once bought 30 kilos of coal, burned it in the fireplace. We managed to keep the room warm for about half an hour after burning 30 kilos of coal. I'm not kidding. This really happened.
Wow.
And the only thing that was warm in the house was actually this dryer that we had going. It pumped hot air out of the back of it. And it turned out that if we closed all the doors to the hallway itself was a much smaller space to heat than any of our rooms were. So instead of sitting in any of our rooms, there was only one power plug left in the house, in the hallway. Basically, all the other power plugs, there's only one per room, you know. So we spent a good portion of that winter just kind of getting out of bed and kind of jumping jack in our sleeping bags towards the dryer in the hallway, so we could huddle next to it. Well, basically, you know, we weren't sitting around playing computer games or watching TV or anything, because those were in our rooms where it was freezing. So we would just sit next to the dryer, and that, you know, that's how we had to spend it. And when I was down there, I was given some weed for the first time in my life, and it was like living in a cartoon. And I'd previously, up to that point, been a complete anti-smoker, anti-drug abuse. In fact, I was looking at some of my diaries that I was writing in, and how much abuse that I had against people who used drugs or smoked cigarettes. I even won the senior speech competition at high school with an anti-smoking speech, and now I'm a smoker, kind of thing. You know, I did a complete role reversal, and I started selling it. Because my flatmate and my girlfriend kind of abandoned me, and I was alone in a city where I didn't know many people, and it was freezing, and I was kind of getting really depressed. And when I was selling cannabis, you know, just small amounts, you know, insignificant really, in the grand scheme of things, I would have all these people come in to my house and talk with me and hang out with me and whatever. And I was later arrested, you know, just in the morning. These cops with their dogs came up the driveway, and I said to them, "Okay, well, hold on there, hold on just a minute, gentlemen." And I would grab all of my paraphernalia, all of my baggies, all of my related drug dealing implements, and just handed it to them, and freely admitted everything that I'd done, that I'd been selling for close to 8 months, and this kind of thing. They never advised me of my rights, and they clamped me in the handcuffs, and was clearly a very nice, genuine, happy person, not a threat of any kind. You know, basically, my own lawyer, as part of his defense for me, was that I was really naive. And when, even with a full confession, the police still manufactured evidence and claimed that I had sold $40,000 worth of cannabis, suddenly things started to click for me, that when I was honest to these police officers, I wasn't being honest to somebody whose job was about being honest or doing the right thing. I was being honest for somebody whose job it is to distort and lie and manipulate and destroy people's lives as systematically as humanly possible. And I got out of there, and I was going to go to jail for up to 8 years, 8 years for a first offense. And that was with being caught with 13 grams. That's how much they caught me with. They caught me with 13 grams. And I could have gone to jail for up to 8 years. They treat it more seriously than manslaughter in this country. And let me just explain the sentencing protocol and how funny this was. The person in front of the person who was in front of me was a ex-heroin addict. And he was charged with theft of a jar of Craig's raspberry jam from the local BP service station. And after the prosecution had delivered evidence and paid their lawyers $165 an hour or whatever to represent this giant, massive BP corporation, that, somebody stole a jar of jam from them, we must punish that person very severely. The judge then ordered that man to pay reparations of $4.32 to replace the jar of Craig's jam. The person directly in front of me was up for sexual assault of his girlfriend, growing cannabis plants. I think he was growing three cannabis plants, cultivation, and resisting arrest. he got 150 hours community service. I come up with a massive record of being an incredibly talented individual, doing plays and getting all these references from university professors who were friends of my friends and my school teachers and parents, family members, etc., going through drug education programs and this sort of thing. I get 300 hours community service. You know, explain that one to me. For 13 grams of the stuff, and it taught me that there wasn't a terribly large amount of justice in the justice system. I mean, because number one, who would I hurt? Whose property had I stolen or damaged? Which people had experienced actual pain and suffering as a result of my actions? Which is what one would equate to a crime. Punishable by imprisonment or something of that nature. None of them. And I went back to work, got all those hours done, went to university, and got a job as a salesperson, telesales. And I became really good at it, really good at telesales. I became the number one for a 6 months sales stretch. I was every single day had more numbers on the board than everybody else for an entirety of 6 months, coming in from complete noob status to within 18 months achieving that status. And it occurred to me that my capacity to talk, to give people clear imagery, and to exert familiarity without any previously existing in a very short time window, allowed me to be the perfect person to communicate, essentially, with people. And I called this manipulation. Make what you want of the word manipulation. I see it as an ambiguous term meaning to either manipulate your pencil to write a great Shakespearean work, or to manipulate the mind of somebody else so that they will do your bidding unwittingly, and I see the relationship like that. And I, through being a high performing work person and being of above average intelligence in those environments, I got bored as soon as I became number one and started looking around to see what else was going on here. And it turned out that the entire massive telco corporation that I was working for had so many problems with everybody who was working in the company, more or less. And instead of doing my sales as per usual, after getting a promotion to business account manager, of which I never actually was ever given any business accounts to manage, it's just sales again, which is what I didn't want to do because I'd already done that and already beaten the pants off of everybody. I didn't feel like I had anything to prove there. So I wrote the 7-page essay about what was wrong with the company, all its training protocols, its provisioning, its sales tactics, its product packages, an entire revamp, essentially, that would have increased efficiency, improved staff retention, and actually increased sales numbers by using honesty, logic, and simple consolidation of its current business interests. Okay, now, for a 21-year-old to come into your company and say that to you, this was the response. We got called into a meeting, me and all the business account managers and the number two, the vice president of the company, essentially. And we start going through these list of things. Everybody around the boardroom is kind of agreeing, going, yeah, that's a good point. And, we can improve that. Big head honcho, about 15 minutes into it, after we'd gone to, I think we'd gotten down halfway of page two out of the 7-page document addressing these issues, before he gets this little text message and he says, okay, I've got to go now. And nothing happened. No improvements were made. No changes. No nothing. And my boss comes and talks to me and says, Vinny, come have a coffee next door. Okay. slaps down a piece of paper in front of me. And he says, sign it. I go, what am I signing? And he says, well, basically, if you leave in 5 minutes, we'll give you $3,000. And I go, okay. Well, I haven't had a summer holiday in quite some time, and I can't be bothered working around here with you scumbags. And it was early December, and I was like, you know what? That would really, really be nice if I could spend a summer after working for these scum for 2 years and having them treat me like this. on their dollar without having to work for it just because I was a bit of a troublemaker, I think that sounds like justice. So I took that money. I had a fabulous holiday. And then the money ran out. And I had to go get another job. And my girlfriend started pestering me for weeks and weeks and months about going to get a job and not staying home. And it was just like, you know, I didn't want to do it anymore. But one day I decided to, and I got a job within 7 minutes, based on my experience and my CV. And they got me into head their sales teams, and I employed a whole. This was a new company that was starting up doing sales, and I started to employ all my different methodologies that I would have employed in the other company, but wasn't allowed to. And suddenly they started growing and doing really good. But then I realized that they were only paying me about 14% of what other people in the other industry would be getting paid to do the exact same thing.
Let me stop here. Just to give some context to this, this is what, about 2006, 2007, something like that?
Yeah, round about
okay.
Then.
All right. Go ahead.
I think this was the second to last job I had, is what I'm explaining now. And I got into the point where I had to go out to appointments, right? And these appointments would sometimes be massive miles away from me. And I had to pay for my own phone calls. I had to pay for my own gas. And it turns out that I was actually getting about $120 into debt after being paid my paycheck every week just in order to do the job. And so I came up and said to them, look, man, I'm going broke working for you. I can't keep doing it. And then all of a sudden, have you ever talked to somebody? And all of a sudden they think that now they're not your slave. And they suddenly, their tone changes, and you suddenly realize what kind of a psychopathic little maggot this person is. That's what happened, you know? Oh, you think you've got us over a barrel now, don't you, Vinny? Just like, okay, now I know who you are. I'm out of here. And incidentally, they then put up all the charges for everybody they put up the workload for everybody and then said, we're not going to give you any more money for this extra workload, even though we're only paying you about 14% of the money you should be getting, which we're all keeping ourselves.
Wow.
So one of the sales team members, leaders that they hired, then started up his own company. And he grabbed me and my mate Mickey, is from England, to be his chief people. And they paid us, and they split it right down the middle with us, full transparency, 50-50 with his money. What I didn't realize about this guy is that he had no thing such as personal boundaries or moral code. He was one of those psycho salesmen, you know what I'm saying? The kind of person who sits there and uses tricks and techniques to convince you of giving him money rather than using honesty and straightforwardness and open dealings in order to produce a mutually beneficial deal. It was all about the money for him.
They're called bankers. Investment bankers. We call them investment bankers. I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
Well, it's true enough. But the thing is, this is a multi-industry, multifaceted psychopathic mentality that I've discovered that is infected and deeply rooted in every sector of our society. So it's not fair to just label it the bankers. You can just lame it at everybody and everything.
Yeah.
You know, that's how bad the situation really is. That was the realization that was dawning on me while I was working for this person. One night he called me at 9:30 on a Friday, and I was at my mate's place having a beer. And he said to me, get up, get off the couch, find a pen, find a piece of paper, and write down the name and number of a client to call on Monday. Okay. And that was not an isolated incident. I started getting really depressed. I couldn't go to work any day without getting myself really, really stoned, essentially. And my mind was unraveling. I was listening to conspiracy theory radio all the time. Like, I would listen to the Alex Jones show repeated twice, usually in an average day, plus an extra couple of documentaries. So it came to the point where after the 6 months that I was working for this guy, I'd watched hundreds, literally hundreds of documentaries and listened to 1,000 hours of conspiracy talk radio. It's a radical worldview switch to go through in such a small amount of time. Such a geometric gain of knowledge did I have that it all started to push down on me, kind of like, I can't be here. I can't be doing this job anymore. I've got better things to do. There are more important things at hand. The world is not going to get better from me selling corporate landline packages to small businesses. The world is not going to get radically better. Things are only going to get radically worse unless I do something radically different in my own life. Now, despite the fact that I didn't like this guy, he did pay me well. My final paycheck was $4,000 cash after tax, and there was also a promotional period that had been going for about 45 days. Within that 45 days, the bonuses were $11,900 worth of Westfield shopping vouchers. There's these big chain malls that they've got here in New Zealand and Australia, right? So they've got all the different shops and everything in there. And when I got that paycheck, it was at a point where I'd started to go out traveling long distances to do these business appointments. And they showed me a bunch of appointments that had been scheduled for people that were just down the road from where I was living that they had previously been giving to this other girl who was working for them who lived miles away. So instead of giving her the miles away things for me and me, the ones next to my doorstep, they've sent us both in radically different directions, traveling huge distances for no good reason. And
wow.
At that realization, I just kind of like was like, man, I want to quit, you know. And I'd never quit a job before in my life, usually. And I must have had like about 20 of them, because as soon as I get really good at something, I get bored and I go into the next thing. But what happened was, I called my friend Jonathan Eisen. From Uncensored Magazine. Now, he kind of previously to my kind of rise was, I'd say, the alternative media source in New Zealand, but all he was doing was a magazine. And I called him up and I said, you know, John, I feel really upset with this job. I want to quit, but I don't know if I should. And he asked me, does it feel right? I said, yeah, it does. And so I quit, and I've never been gainfully employed since. I mean, I went to a couple of job interviews since that, but both of those job interviews resulted in me having a hyperventilation degree panic attack, because all of my previous bad experiences of being shafted and shuffled around by these corporate filth who essentially just had no real morals or ethics. I couldn't work for them. And I defined it as being employophobic, being afraid of being employed. And that was what essentially drove me so headlong into doing new media. I don't want to call it alternative media because it's not alternative. It's the new media. And what does that imply of the other media that's currently out there? It's the old media, old, crusty, unevolved type media, something that is long past its use-by date and is no longer popular and is no longer useful. And it's simple. If you want to create media, do you have a device that is capable of recording something? Most people are capable of getting something for only a few $100. I had a Mac computer and a small handycam and a tripod, and that's all I started off with. And I went out to protests that were happening, you know, all the time. You'd be surprised how many protests are actually happening in your neck of the woods if you're looking. They happen all the time, but they're never reported on. And if they are reported on, there'll be one soundbite of a protest organizer that means nothing outside of the context of what they're talking about. So I went to all these protests and I thought to myself, who are the people that I should be actually approaching with this camera? You see the people with the megaphones, you see the people speaking to the crowds on the microphones, and you hone in them, you go in there, and you ask them who they are and what they do. All of a sudden, you realize that this person's been focusing on this issue for about 20 years, and they haven't been idly sitting by for 20 years. In fact, they've been doing intense research, much activism, and have been in the media, at least in small snippets and what have you, for the bulk of all of that time. Suddenly, when you're talking to them for 10, 15, 20 minutes, or any length of period of time, you begin to absorb an enormous wealth of knowledge and a much deeper understanding of any issue. And that was my strength, is I'm a very malleable, coachable personality. And I found all these people who, in general, were broke, in general, had jobs, and in general were just going out and doing the right thing because they knew that it was the right thing, not because there was anything really in it for them. In fact, quite the contrary, they lose everything that they once had and that they once hold dear, being an activist. And I felt that the media, instead of making famous and giving coverage to people who talk about nothing or are essentially shallow, vacuous vessels, you should instead give the coverage to those whom deserve it, those who have sweat, blood, and tears pouring out of them for these issues of which they know everything about. Those are the people that deserve the coverage. And I kept making videos. Almost every day I was going out to a new protest or to a new activist or something like that. And I started to accumulate this rather vast video library online of real, intelligent news. And I had no experience, no training, nothing. And I was able, with minimal resources, if any, to beat out the mainstream media online. If you have a look on YouTube for the rankings for New Zealand, for the news and information, any of the channels that are actually putting out news under the auspices of being a quote-unquote mainstream media apparatus are performing at vastly less than my channel that I'm operating by myself. The largest up until a year ago when I surpassed them was New Zealand Herald, which is the equivalent of the New York Times or Associated Press of New Zealand. I currently have more subscribers than they do. And it's easy to see why. It's because when people have a choice, they don't choose to go to mainstream media online. They choose to go to the new media because they get information there that the mainstream simply does not provide for one reason or another. And I started this organization called Guerrilla Media, guerrillamedia.co.nz, for the Americans listening. And the idea was to give a free publishing house to these activists, so that they could put up their videos, they could put up their blogs automatically without actually having to physically do it, just so that people would have a main area or source to come to deliver news and information from all of the different spectrums, especially with those people who completely disagree with each other, so that you would get both different points of view, radically different points of view, with supporting documentation and information in the same space. And that's been growing, not as fast as I would hope, because the person who I had set up that website for me essentially flaked out, and he decided that he didn't want to save anybody. He didn't want to fight against the New World Order. He wanted to keep his head down and work for them in the hope that he might become one of their pets at a later point and be spared extermination that he believed was ultimately coming. And as a result... and as a result, not possessing the skills that he did. He's one of the top programmers in the world, essentially. And he's working for some very shady, massive company, kind of extremely paranoid guy now. But as a result of being left in the lurch of that, in that sense, Guerrilla Media, the website, looks like crap. I mean, seriously, look at the website, guerrillamedia.co.nz, and you tell me that website looks good. No, it doesn't. It looks like crap because I can't change anything about it. And very few people even possess the skill to change anything about it, even as it were, right? That was something that taught me about what happens when you rely on other people, okay? Namely, you cannot. You must be self-reliant. Conversely, because of my activism and the propensity of my YouTube channel to get out there, ambushing the Prime Minister, John Key, the former Prime Minister, who's now number three at the UN, I believe she might have been even promoted yet, Helen Clark, who had a $9 million salary and a $9 billion budget giving vaccines to Africa that are all loaded up with sterilants and AIDS viruses and all of that kind of stuff, isn't she loving and caring and left? So out of ambushing all of these prominent people, I became noticed by a guy named Mitch Santel, who's now my producer. At the time, he was producing a show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com called The American Freedom Report. And it was hosted by Dave Von Kleist of 9/11 in Plain Sight, very good documentary out there, and a Mr. Brent Johnson, the voice of freedom, who in his heyday occupied the number one slot, the number one position for his time slot in syndicated talk radio in the greater Los Angeles area. And Dave had the official story is, and I'll only tell you the official story. You can probably find out the other details for yourself if you ever wanted to. But the official story is Dave was in Argentina, and his connections weren't very good, so he couldn't continue to co-host the show. So Brent took the helm, and he held auditions like week by week with different hosts, and Mitch, who at the time had New Zealand's most prominent truther YouTube channel, something like 10,000 subscribers or getting there, since been pulled off online, even though he had permission for everybody to re-upload videos, but they got me on as the co-host for a week. And instead of being in the last position in terms of popularity of the shows via the ratings for American Freedom Radio, it bumped up to third position just in the week that I was on there. And I was noticed by the owner of the network, Danny Romero, who used to produce Alex Jones. And eventually he cancelled our show, American Freedom Report, which we changed into the Global Freedom Report, you know, co-hosted by an American and a New Zealander, cancelled it, and then just gave it to me. And I've been doing it ever since. I started off with a co-host, Will. He couldn't even make it to 8 months. The intensity of talk radio and your long-lasting capacity in it escapes most people. They think that it's just talking. Mm-mm-mm. When you're thinking, when you're researching, when you're interviewing, when you're... And here's the thing. For the first almost year of my show, the local time that I had to get up and do this show was 3 till 5 a.m., 5 days a week. Okay? Now, ladies and gentlemen...
It's a pretty demanding schedule, yep.
If you want to prove your mettle in talk radio, do a 3 till 5 a.m. show for 5 days a week for a year and see if you can handle it. This is why most... close on 90 to 99% of talk radio shows don't last it through their first year. It is so demanding. It is so difficult. And there is so much organization and editing and uploading and workload involved that ordinary people simply cannot do it. It's not possible. It is preserved for a special breed of opinionated, generally egotistical, and very sharp-minded individuals, usually males, who get into this. The ego part of it, if anybody knows me, you know that I have a monstrous ego. However, my ego does not take precedence over other people, usually when I have relationships with them. Collaboration is my favorite thing to do, not competition. When you collaborate, I cut my ego in half and I leave that other half at the door. You cut your ego in half, you leave that at the door. And with what the half of what remains with each of us, we put that together and it becomes a work or a greater entity of energy than either of us could ever be on our own. But if you did not have that strong will that an ego allows you, you're simply not capable of surviving the amount of abuse, pressure, sleep deprivation, economic deprivation, stress, depression, general frustration, the ostracizing, and the family problems, the relationship woes, all of these things suddenly come into play. You realize that you're not just somebody doing a radio show. You realize you're actually somebody who's doing a job, and your job still comes with it. All of those other things around you, all the social, the political, and the relationship type issues that come with any form of employment. My girlfriend Sarah's, I mean, I would not be here doing the show with you guys today if it was not for Sarah supporting me for all those years. I've now conveniently got subscribers who give me $5 a month, $10 a month, $20 a month. One of them, Chris up north here in New Zealand, who's from America, gives me $35 a month. He's a very lovely guy. Simply just not because they're buying or purchasing anything, or they're getting something they can't get for free, but because they see a need for what I'm doing. And it becomes about the relationship of power and responsibility. A lot of people say that great power comes with great responsibility. I disagree. I think with taking great responsibility on your shoulders, you get given great power as a result because you have earned it. You know how to use it. You know how to essentially curb yourself. Power, in my opinion, is not about exercising power. Power, in my opinion, is actually about exercising restraint over oneself. If you are incapable of restraining yourself, then you should never be given power. And I've had this theory for a long time that if you ever gain any power where you cannot be held accountable, if I'm the most powerful person in the room, and if somebody criticizes me and I can just say, shut up, get out of here, and then they cease to be capable of criticizing me, they cannot arrest me, they cannot pull me up, there's no accountability, no transparency, no responsibility, then there would be nothing to stop me from becoming the very monster that I started doing all this stuff with to begin with, to fight against. And as a direct result of that realization, I have tended to start accumulating friendships and relationships with what I consider the chief scumbaggery exposers of our time. People like G. Edward Griffin. If you go to Freedom Force International's website and you click on the Hall of Honor list, these are people who G. Edward Griffin himself has personally selected to be on this list as individuals who he believes are fighting for truth, decency, and individual liberty in the world. Number one on that list is Alex Jones. Number 12 on that list is Vinnie Eastwood. You have credibility when somebody endorses you in such a way. And I have so many of these types of friends who routinely expose corruption, that if I were to ever, ever behave corruptly, or heaven forbid, turn into some form of douchebag, they would expose me and kick me off my pedestal as quickly as humanly possible so that I could not use my position of power to hurt other people, to destroy any part of this greater patriotism and truth movement, because ultimately it's not about me. I'm merely a face and a name that's trying to give prominence and coverage to other people. It is very rare that I'll even expose or even bring new information to the fold. I'm not a researcher. I'm not a trained journalist. I'm simply a fun guy, kind of like Mold, who brings on people of all different persuasions, whether or not I know what they're going to be talking about, just to hear them speak, just to give them a platform, just to talk about something that's important for a change. And I can guarantee you, at any point in time that you listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, you will learn more through your course of listening to my show than you will on virtually any other. That ain't me tooting my own horn. This is the words of the listeners. There was one day that I was really, really upset after the elections. And, of course, the elections make us all really upset, unless, of course, we have a bottle of tequila handy. And I pleaded with the listeners to call in and give me some encouragement because I was just at burnout point. And call after call after call just streamed in, telling me how much they love me, telling me how much they appreciate my show, telling me how they've been listening to talk radio for 20 years. And in the last 6 months of listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show 5 days a week, they'd learned more than the previous 20 years combined because of the variance of the guests and the detail and the basically the emotion that I really put into this. This is real stuff that we're talking about here. This isn't some far-fetched fantasy. There are real people out there who are living and dying because of the things that we're talking about. You know? These are the important issues of our time. And very rarely do we get to discuss things of such importance. And so it's good for people to be able to hear it regularly, something that they've never heard before, something that takes their minds and their research fields into an entirely new direction, as does with me, because it's more or less a public service broadcast that I'm doing, because most of the guests that we have are indeed suggestions from the listeners. So the bulk of my listening audience, guys, is between the 40 and 65 age range, the baby boomers, okay? They're the people who in general are tuning into me. And they're the people who have had experience of the New World Order. They've seen it for decades upon decades. And they're the people who are sending in all these guest suggestions. And so not only do they gain from hearing these guests interviewed in a way that perhaps they've never heard before, in a very open format where we have a few laughs and what have you, but also I gain from all of this. So I grow personally in my developmental stages, much like a fetus in an amniotic sac, just as much as the audience can. So we're all going through this journey and this experience together. And I've never felt so alive as to know that because of my actions, other people's lives are greatly improved. There was even one time when one of our listeners was going to commit suicide. You know, she was very sick, very upset with life, very, very depressed, and she just wanted to end her own life. And then she started listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, The Lighter Side of Genocide, and was laughing her ass off every day. And suddenly she didn't want to die anymore. She wanted to keep listening to the show.
You got to love that, Vinnie. I'll tell you what an articulate image, word picture you created. You know, what you said is exactly what we go through in terms of, well, it's a process. I mean, you described a process that we go through as well. And it's interesting. Our demographics are pretty similar in terms of listenership. I mean, I think ours are 35 to 60, or I think, would you say 40 to 65 or something like that?
Around about, yeah.
Yeah. Ours are the same as well. And the core audience, that is. And I think that people, you know what, Vinny, after listening to you, I think people are thirsty, hungry for the knowledge that they can't get elsewhere. They're not getting elsewhere. And that's the reason for your existence and your success, I believe. Would you agree with that?
It's one of the many. If you take current existing individuals who have been working in their field for many years and are now getting old and a bit long in the tooth, and eventually somebody will rise to replace them, these would be the individuals I'd pick out that maybe parts of what I wish to achieve would be kind of explained. George Norrie.
Yep.
George Carlin. Bill Hicks. These are comedians. And Rupert Murdoch, you know? Essentially, I want to be a very gracious host and good listener and good interpreter for the people, like George Norrie is, with his 29, 30-plus million listeners. I want to be a philosopher and a freer of the minds through comedy, much like Bill Hicks and George Carlin was. And I also want to have a multimedia international conglomerate whereby I can give the power of access to media to the people who currently deserve it, rather than the methodology of News Corp, which is to preserve media coverage for those who do not. And the way it would work is, let's say you've got $1 million studio. Now with only a couple of $100 a week, really, is what I'm living off, you know, bones of my ass type thing, I'm capable now of competing dollar for dollar with the mainstream media in New Zealand. Okay?
Right.
It's just that simple. That's how effective one person can be with the new media. If you have a Mac computer, you suddenly have audio editing software, voice capture, video capture, and video editing capacity, and that's just with the things that are stock standard. So you've automatically got a media apparatus. You've already got a studio and a sound room and everything all packed into this one sleek little package. And what I wish to do is to actually give that kind of tool and access to those types of tools, preferably for free, or in some description of a non-profit basis, to any activist who walks in off the street. You know, seriously. You want to know how to do a radio show or a radio broadcast? Well, we're not going to tell you and then let you do it on your own. We're actually going to come inside, sit down. You're now the radio show host for 2 hours. See how you go. And then you show them, before the radio broadcast actually starts, exactly how all the little apparatus works, all the technical details. So, and after the radio show, you actually get them to sit down at the computer with this audio archive, know how to have captured it in the first place, put it into the editor, edit it out in whatever format they wish to, learn how to publish it, learn how to put up a website, and then upload that audio broadcast to that website. And then, when they leave that office, they will never again need to come back, because you've given them all of the tools and the training that they need in one afternoon for them to do whatever they want in radio. And you give them the freedom and the power to do that by allowing everybody to have that same opportunity. That opportunity was never given to me. I had to do it all myself. And that's part of my conflict as well with this, is that all of these other people that I've helped gain prominence and done videos for and what have you, have never gone on to do their own radio programs, have never gone on to start their own YouTube channels per se and do news in maybe the way that I did them, because I was doing it all for them. Maybe that's, I don't know exactly what the balance that needs to be struck here. I simply know that whatever we got now with a centralized control ain't working. So let's just do the direct opposite, and you will produce a desirable result, I believe.
You're right on the money, Vinny. The people who are in the places of alternative media or in the regular mainstream media don't deserve to be there, don't have that drive, the motivation to get to the truth, and the people who are in the alternative media do, and the roles need to be reversed. Folks, you're listening to the Hagman & Hagman Report this Monday, November 19th, 2012. We'll be right back with our special guest, Vinny, from the Vinny Eastwood Show.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the Hagman & Hagman Report today. This is a live broadcast. Today is the 19th day of November 2012. It's a Monday. It's Tuesday, actually, in New Zealand, which is the location, which is where our special guest is talking from. Our very special guest is Mr. Vinny Eastwood, the host of the Vinny Eastwood Show. Major part of the new media in the Southern Hemisphere. And I just want to welcome Mr. Eastwood back. And I want to, before we get back to Mr. Eastwood, however, I do want to make a couple of quick announcements. Number one, we want to thank everyone, by the way, who tuned in last night for a special three-hour broadcast with Steve Quayle. Magnificent program, folks. If you haven't heard it, go ahead and download it. Steve was on point and very, very incisive in terms of the message in which he delivered. Certainly, it was very well received. Joe and I talked earlier today, and we talked talked with our families as well. What our plans are for Thanksgiving. Look, we know, we understand, ladies and gentlemen, that this is a kind of a slow news week for radio personalities, radio shows. There's a lot of subs going on and what have you. That said, we have decided, because you are our extended family, that's the way we look at it, because the news is always so dire and has been dire here over the last, especially over the last several weeks. And we realize that a lot of people don't have families. They're alone. They spend their time alone. And, we want to invite you to our virtual table. So we're going to be doing a live show on Thanksgiving and, of course, a live show on Friday. This is a part of, look, folks, we live in some very perilous times. And, it's when you're alone, or even if you're not alone, but especially if you're alone, it can weigh heavy on your mind, your heart, and your presence. I'll tell you what, we want to invite you to be a part of our Thanksgiving. And this is how we're choosing to spend our Thanksgiving. That's with our listeners. And we'll be going through some new, obviously news and what have you, but the fellowship which we can provide and we can all be a part of is a big part of that as well. So we'll be live on Thanksgiving, and we're looking forward to that, to our extended family. But for tonight, we're graced with Mr. Vinny Eastwood. Very humbled to have him on for the balance of the program. Again, he is the Vinny of the Vinny Eastwood Show out of New Zealand, and he hits a lot of hot topics, a lot of topics that other hosts will not touch, and a lot of information, a lot of topics that are on your mind, our listeners. It's a marvelous overlay here. Vinny, welcome back to the program. Mr. Eastwood, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, man. Okay. Well, I just wanted to broach the topic as well, just the amount of different people that I have on the show. Kind of, it's like, you know how the old term of standing on the shoulders of giants to touch the sky, as it were. And if you go to the featured interviews page of the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, it's up there, up the top, and you just read down through this list of people that I've had on the show: David Icke, George Norrie, Foster Gamble, Heinrich Palmgren, Lindsay Williams, Jordan Maxwell, Benjamin Fulford, Taylor Tequila, Andrew Brashago, Bernard Mendez, Nancy Duterte, Jan Irvin, John A. Rush, Rosa Corey, Dr. Janet Hull, Anthony Peak, James Corbett, Robert Menard, Cliff High, Sheriff Richard Mack, Sean David Morton, Sydney Ross Singer, Catherine Albrecht, Stuart and Janet Swerdlow, Len Horowitz and Sherry Kane, Ian Wishart, G. Edward Griffin, Webster Tarpley, Bob Chapman, Steve Quayle, Rick Simpson, Dr. Rima Labo, Paul Connor. You know, it just basically reads like the who's who of truthers, more or less.
Exactly.
And you know, the reason why we get these people is not necessarily just so that we can sponge their audience off or whatever. Is actually, when you come on my show, the appropriate mood that you're supposed to be on is like you're taking a holiday on an island in the sun with a cocktail in your hand, and you're just having an interesting conversation, okay? Imagine you're in a cafe, and you're just two intelligent people having an ordinary conversation. It just turns out that there's a whole bunch of people listening to that conversation. It's a relaxed atmosphere. And
right.
I do this specifically because I understand that when you are in the spotlight, when you are attacking the New World Order, you are under pressure. You are under stress. And I try to provide a reprieve for these people using humor so that they can just keep continuing to do what they're doing. And a lot of people say to people like me, maybe people like yourselves, I'm sure you've had a lot of people say, please keep up the good work. But very few people actually contribute in some way to, in fact, help you to keep up the good work. You know, few people by measure of the audiences that we have tuning into us will donate or contribute or suggest guests. Most people are simply there to do the listening, not the interacting. And what I seek to do is to tell people, look, you now have the opportunity to interact through my broadcast. You can call in. You can participate in the chat rooms. You can suggest guests of any size or stature. And eventually we'll probably get them on, provided they're not douchebags that blow me off. Because there was this one time, this one guy, I forget who it was, emailed me back and he goes, "The lighter side of genocide? No thanks." And I just replied to him and just said, well, that's okay, man. Not everybody's got a sense of humor.
You've got to have, look, I mean, we deal with heavy topics. I mean, really do.
On a nightly basis, and that's all on air, on not including all the constant research off air, the things you read, the horror stories, and the knowledge of knowing where we are headed. Listening to you give your history in the first hour was very, you know, nice and relaxing. It was a change of pace and from, you know, the regular we have here, which is, you know, it gets very intense and heated with very important, you know, life-changing information. So we do need
you can strike a good balance there. But yeah, I've got to say, I've heard a number of your interviews, and you strike a necessary balance because, you know, you get into that zone, if you will, and it's, you know, the intensity of battle wears on you. But let me ask you a question here. If we can here take this to some topical issues of today. I mean, you're a relatively young man, but you're wise in years. Based on what I've seen, what's on your radar, Vinny? What's at the core of your focus right now?
Thanksgiving. What I will be thankful for over Thanksgiving is taking a holiday.
All right.
American Freedom Radio is going to be going off air on this Thursday and Friday for the Thanksgiving weekend, and the next week after that, I will actually be taking off, completely off,
okay,
of doing work. What's on my mind mostly is that every single day I do more work than all the alternative media outlets in New Zealand combined, roughly, in terms of hours of content and radio and video produced per day. I produce more in a day than most outlets here will produce in a month. And I have this this feeling, of course, that, well, basically, the alternative media is a kind of like crabs in a bucket. You know, how the old adage works is that as soon as one crab starts to get himself onto the edges of the bucket and can pull himself out, the other crabs will simply grab him by a leg and pull him back in, and all of a sudden here we are mushing around in the middle. This is why I've become remarkably independent, so that I don't have to be in the bucket with the rest of these crabs. You know what I'm saying? Becoming independent media is actually the main focus of what I do, namely not relying on other people. So if my producer decides that he needs to take 2 months off, I already have all the bases covered by myself to produce the show and make things happen with or without his help. Same with American Freedom Radio. If they were to cancel my show tomorrow, I would be still capable of recording and uploading everything by myself. Or if suddenly a whole bunch of these other alternative media outlets in New Zealand who I've been asking to give me content or come on my radio show or do video interviews with me and what have you, if they were suddenly unable to, you should see, in general, the best shows that I do are usually the ones where I have a very big guest scheduled who doesn't turn up, because that energizes me and kind of produces this this sort of air of energetic frustration of which I'm capable of laying out in an articulate format that actually really gets to people and gets under their skin, and they really feel what I'm feeling. And in so doing, they feel the motivation that I feel to do more in the face of others doing less. You know, that's the obligation that you have inherent when you are in the new media. If I don't do it, nobody else will. And in New Zealand, it's absolutely true. If I don't do it, if I was not doing my 5 day a week radio show, putting up videos every single day, four or five a day, as well. And just bear in mind, there is no production team. I am the janitor. I am the producer. I organize the vast majority of the guests, and I do all the audio archiving and uploading and blogging and video editing and uploading and tagging and all of that kind of stuff, and all the Facebooking and all the Twitter and all of the social networking and everything, more or less entirely by myself. Now,
yes, sir.
This difficulty,
so
in terms of the issues, though, it means that I don't have a whole lot of time to research into things, and it means that monitoring news and other people's radio shows and what's really going on right now, right here, in a news-based format, becomes almost a physical impossibility, because I have too many other roles that I play, and I have yet to have research assistants and things of that nature. But it's easy enough. You can just grab an article or listen to mainstream talk radio for minutes, and all of a sudden I've got enough material to rant on for a whole 2 hours, because of the mere fact that I know what's going on, because I already have found out years in advance. For example, this Sunday, I was coming to a friend's place, and I was listening to the radio, waiting for him to arrive, and they were doing a 4-minute segment on the TPPA, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. I'm not sure if you guys have heard of this, but you'd recognize it as a NAFTA or GATT for New Zealand, essentially, and
right.
And other Pacific Rim nations. And this was on Sunday, in the middle of the day, on the national radio program, when virtually nobody's listening, saying that this TPPA is draconian. It is secret. It is behind closed doors. It impinges on national sovereignty. It destroys the economic capacity of smaller outfits and newcomers to any type of free marketplace. And it also holds the governments hostage to major corporations who may not have particularly high levels of conscience in their business practice. Now, I knew all of this 2+ years ago, and I've been screaming about it for ages. And only now does the mainstream media even cover it. But when they do cover it, they cover it when nobody's listening.
Well, typical. That's typical. And one can argue, Vinny, that is the reason for your existence and our existence, to expose this when people are listening, or to expose this to people who deliberately listen. People tune into our show to listen to what's going on. I mean, they want to know the news. If people are going to invest 3 hours in our show, they want to walk away, you know, with something with more knowledge than when they walked in, you know, turned on our show. So obviously is that not the reason that you exist and we exist?
Well, I don't know. My reason for existence, I don't know. But I took responsibility for being New Zealand's alternative media, and now I am. So regardless for the reason of my existence, it is my actions that have defined who I am now.
Well, okay, that's fair enough. I mean, yeah, we can walk that through, and I think you've done an outstanding job of doing that.
Yeah, I mean, really, aside from the small details, deciding to make a difference, doing things on your own, starting your own media, what we did, we just started, picked up, and we are where we are today because of the hard work we put in for, you know, years before. And
But Vinny, well, let me ask you this, though. I mean, I just want to be clear, because I think this is where we're at here. We are fighting this. We're both, I mean, we're warriors for the truth, are we not? I mean, you bring guests on to give them the platform to inform your listeners. We do the same thing, attempting to get to the bottom of what's really going on out there in the world. I mean, we're fighting a massive war here. We're a war for all the marbles, a war for our lives, basically. Are we not?
Well, you guys can fight the war. I'm going to keep the backline troops patched up in the medical tent. That's my role. Not to be on the front line, but to be the entertainment on the backline for the troops who are tired and distraught, who have seen too much already.
Okay. Well, that's fair enough. I mean,
let me define this for you. A war effort comprises of the front line and the back line, and neither can exist without each other. The front line troops will starve to death or succumb to their wounds and injuries via contact with the enemies if there is no back line with hot showers, nice food, and clean sheets and beds, and a medical tent to patch them up and some of that nature. Okay, so without the front line being supported by the back line, the front line would fall over very, very quickly, wouldn't it? But conversely, it works the other way. If all you had is the back line and the lovey-dovey people who were trying to help you and what have you, but you had no front line to defend against direct attackers, they'd be annihilated, wouldn't they? So I see this as a symbiotic relationship. Now, in terms of warriors, yes, I agree. We are in a war to save our very lives, our very souls, and the very future for forebears, and to save the memory of our ancestors so that they can be in existence for future generations to benefit from their knowledge and wisdom. And I feel that my elders, anybody who's older than me, or anybody who has experience, you know that old saying that everybody's got a story? Often, these stories that people will tell me are very traumatic for them. And yet, when they're telling them to me, not only am I listening very intently and understanding exactly what they're on about because of my base of knowledge that I've accumulated over the years talking to many such people. They also have a sort of like this warm, fuzzy feeling. This guy, Vinny, actually cares about me. This guy, Vinny, is actually trying to help me. I haven't given him any money. I haven't given him any huge projects or anything like this. He's just coming to listen to me and to help me and to make me laugh, even though I'm talking about things for which are simply not funny. The uniquity of this experience that I provide on my platform is paramount, essentially. If you can find somebody else who's a Truth or Talk radio show host who is guaranteed, no matter the caliber of your guest, to get them on and make them laugh, you point them out. I can't see that person. I am that person. I've become what I wanted to see in the world. You know, Tony Blair came here to New Zealand. And a friend of mine comes up to me filming in his iPhone. He says, "Vinny, what are you here today?" And I say, "Well, I'm, apart from standing up against genocide and useless, vile, psychopathic criminal scum like the former Prime Minister Tony Blair, other than that, I don't really have much of a reason to be here. I just want to be here with a frickin' megaphone to say what I think of this guy. And so that's why I'm here, to do it, because I want to see it happen." And then I get on the megaphone and I go, "Tony Blair is a scumbag, engaging in untold quantities of scumbaggery. And for $350 a seat, you can shake the hand of this oily, filthy scumbag too. And for $1,000 a seat, you can get a snapshot where the filth will last forever, incapable of being corrupted and touched by human hands. Oh yes, it's worth the investment." So despite the fact that I'm coming out and I'm saying something very funny, I'm actually saying it truthfully. And as Charlie Veitch and the Love Police proved, saying something that's kind of a joke through a megaphone...
let me tell you something, all right?
All right.
Look, for as much as I respect what you're doing, I've got to tell you that we're not a, you know, look, we've got some standards here, and I didn't catch it. I wasn't sure the first couple of times because of the accent here. We've got to be respectful toward people of color, okay? I certainly would object to that language being used on our program.
The word scumbag.
No. The N word for people.
I didn't use the N word.
Oh, okay. Then I. It certainly sounded like.
But that. It didn't make sense.
Okay. I don't know. Something phone, and I didn't catch that.
Megaphone.
Megaphone. Oh, that makes. You know, that makes me feel better. I thought, wait a minute, this guy's having a meltdown. This guy. Thank you for clearing that up. I sat here with my mouth open. I'm thinking of something on video. I'm thinking, wait a minute, this guy's having. Okay. See,
you ever heard of the
laugh.
You ever heard of the film Lost in Translation?
No, but I certainly was there, let me tell you.
Anyway, let me clear up my original point there.
Go on.
Yeah, if you've ever seen The Love Police, Charles Veitch over in the United Kingdom, or as I like to call it, the Uber Kingdom, the UK, he goes out and he's basically telling jokes through megaphones, and everything that you say through a megaphone is instantly a lot funnier. All right.
Okay, I get that now.
it's undeniable, because normally because it comes at you sideways, essentially it bypasses your defense mechanisms. When you're listening to somebody through a megaphone, you expect it to either be A, an authority figure like a police officer saying please get back, clear the roads, or B, a protester saying this is an evil corporation and listing out facts and details in a very serious manner. There's no comedy essentially translatable through a megaphone that people are familiar with. So when you come out and you tell jokes through it, the shock of it and the fact that it doesn't fit is so much funnier than people realize. And that's why I'm always kind of like the, you know how some people are the life of the party? I'm the life of the protest. You know,
I don't doubt that. Okay, I don't doubt that.
I can give you a visual aid, actually. Hold on a second. I'll just pick this up. Now, for those of you who are watching on the YouTube, as I'll be putting it out, I'm holding a 100-watt megaphone. Okay, this thing is about, I don't know, 30 pounds or something. It's not a light piece of equipment. And it has this little wireless aerial here that connects to a microphone, and it has a tripod. So often what I'll be doing is I could just be a one-man protest. I've got 100 watts of megaphoning capacity that can reach you hundreds and hundreds of meters down a road, that can reach you inside a corporate building, and it can pierce through every single wall. My friends who gave me this megaphone just to use, it's kind of like on permanent loan, really, used two of them, and there are only four in New Zealand of this size and scope, and they used them on the Central Court building of Auckland in New Zealand here, the City Court, and they were talking about how they are pedophiles, talking about how they are corrupt, talking about all of these very, very serious things and exposing their corruption and their eclectic scumbaggery right there. And they later heard reports from people that everybody, even up on the 16th floor, heard every single word they were saying, even in the open courtrooms. That is the power. Okay, that is the power of the truth. You cannot escape from it. You cannot hide from it. And that is the essentially one of the main lessons of my show, is that you don't have to necessarily be the loudest voice or the most numerous voice, but you can amplify what you say to increase its effect and increase the number of ears and eyes that will observe what you are doing. You understand? My goal is not necessarily to make myself the number one truther in the world, although that's kind of, I would love to kind of be in that position so I could help more and more people, but I fear the power and the excess responsibility and whether or not I would change as a man under such situations. But the main goal stays the same. You give amplification to those voices who deserve it. Nothing more, nothing less. That's all you're trying to do. And you don't have to be balanced about it either. The mainstream media wish to provide balance by showing 2 1-minute myopic segments of two people who are wrong. That's what they call balance. My idea of balance is to completely ignore all mainstream sides of the debate and simply tell the truth, which would never make it in to either side of the debate. And even if it did, it would be too small and for too short a period of time to change anything or to help anybody learn from the experience. That's really ultimately what I wish to do, is to help people learn as I'm learning. I'm not asking anybody to do anything I'm not prepared to do myself. That's why I never encourage people to go out and be violent. When I was a boy, my father beat us and and they got divorced at the age of when I was 10 years old, I think, and I barely even saw my father up until that point. And as a direct result of having a violent father and no real strong non-violent male role models, I became a very violent child. And I think the last time I ever laid a hand on somebody was when I was 15. A friend of mine had stolen something from me, wouldn't give it back. So I just jumped on him, ripped a whole chunk of his hair off, you know, just ripped it right off of his head, whole handful of it. And then I went, okay. And I walked down to the assistant principal's office. And I put the clump of hair down on his desk. And I said, I need you to suspend me and send me home. And he did.
Okay, well.
And that was like the 17th and final time that I was ever suspended from school, because I realized at that point that after I'd attacked my friend, that I was never going to lay a hand on anybody ever again. You know, and violence is not my forte. However, I have a wicked tongue. And by God, I can be a nasty piece of work to people. And I fear that. Capacity in myself, and I still have so much anger and fear and hatred and malice, essentially flowing through me. A lot of vindictive thoughts come to mind when I think about all these people that have done me wrong. And I've always been a fan of the concept of revenge. And it occurred to me that when I was being violent, when I was being malicious, when I was being mean to people, it wasn't that they had done me wrong. It was that the entire system had done all of us wrong and told us to blame each other for it instead of the system itself. So this show that I do and this conversation that I'm having with you guys right now is in essence my daily revenge against all these terrible things that myself and almost everybody else that I've ever known has been suffering under their entire lives, completely and utterly unaware. And to deliver that plate, not cold, as the Klingons would say, revenge is a dish best served cold. I think it's actually best served warm, to let those people know that despite the fact that they've filled me full of hate and vengeance and anger and sorrow, I can still smile, and I can still laugh, and there is no greater revenge for somebody who would rather see you cry and be full of hate.
Right, but you cannot tolerate, okay, because, you know, look, Vinny, we're looking at an agenda. I mean, on your website, of course, you know, you reference eugenics, of course, you know, combination of the YouTube symbol with eugenics and such. These are heavy topics. These are the agendas of the globalists. We've got people in power here that are preying on humanity. We've got a generation of young people now growing up that really have never experienced freedom, true freedom, here, at least in America. So I guess where I'm coming from is, you've got a huge megaphone, but what's behind that megaphone? What is behind the megaphone? What is the message? Who are we going after? Who are we attempting to expose? What's the job here? Because at the end of the day, Vinny, do we not have a job to do for our fellow man, for ourselves?
It depends, because you can come away with it using two different tactics, one being attack, one being defense. And one would know that the best defense is often a good offense. You know what I'm saying? So
sure.
The people that I'm attacking are essentially the powerful, and they're those who are meant to be in fiduciary levels of responsibility: judges, lawyers, doctors, politicians, military men, essentially, who have since abdicated such responsibility, transparency, and accountability from their positions. As a direct result, almost every single one of their actions day by day results in a nothing less than an all-out assault on every fiber of the human condition. Now, I come out and simultaneously am I attacking these people and ambushing them personally, rushing up to them with a camera and asking them the questions that the media will not ask them. But my primary methodology is not necessarily to expose them, not necessarily to wake people up, but to simply do what I think is right and to defend those things that I hold sacred. The things I hold sacred are things like freedom, right, freedom of speech, love, and creativity, entrepreneurship, these friendship, collaboration. These are things that are completely and utterly discouraged by the system. People are not encouraged to be independent. They're encouraged to go into dependence, which is what we now call globalization, interdependence. So as if all forms of independence, including the family unit, including freedom of religion, including freedom of gainful employment, including the ability to start up and make a new business or a product by yourself and go out and suddenly start competing on the open market, all of those things are being tightened around us. And the stress of this reality, for those people who realize it, is huge. And it drives a lot of us mad. It really does. Because when you're dealing with the attacks on you all the time, and instead of defending yourself, you're attacking back, it turns it into a protracted war. And Sun Tzu, who wrote The Art of War, warned against protracted wars because they are not only incredibly expensive for the both sides fighting them, but they also wear out your soldiers and they wear out the people at the same time. So ultimately, he was in favor of intelligent misdirection, ambush type tactics, and choosing the field of battle. And this field that I'm choosing to kind of fight it on, I'm kind of taking what's already been done and simply taking it a step further. Now, my defensive action is on the minds and the hopes and the dreams of the people. You know, kind of everybody's really upset. They've still got a slave job. They got boring information. They don't like how they're living. They're getting depressed. They're losing themselves to drugs, alcohol, and debauchery in one sense or the other. So if I come out and instead of saying that person is a scumbag and I'm going to expose them, as well as say that, I also say, you're beautiful and you don't need them anymore. You are complete and contained by yourself. Your job is not who you are. Your wallet is not who you are. Your fashion sense is not who you are. The place where you grew up is not who you are. Who you are is what you do. Okay? And you can either go, you can either go out there and do the right thing and serve those people around you and make them your primary focus for the existence of you, okay? To actually obligate yourself, not because somebody told you to do it, but because your conscience tells you to do it. If you do nothing in the face of such scumbaggery, heaven help you. Because I wouldn't be able to live with myself had I still been going out there getting wasted every single fracking weekend and having essentially nothing to look forward to the next week other than taking orders from somebody who doesn't care about me or where I've come from or doesn't wish to help me expand in some way. That would never, never again satisfy me. I can't do that anymore. There is only one thing to do, and that's what I'm here to do. That's what I'm doing. And I don't know, people doubt themselves and they talk themselves out of doing the right thing so often that they wind up doing nothing at all. You know, I mean, I know so many people who've been saying, Vinny, you'll have no effect. You're pathetic. You're just whinging and whining, or you're just doing this all for yourself, and you'll never amount to anything. I'm just like, okay, have a look at the subscribers on my YouTube channel. More than the mainstream media here in New Zealand. In fact, almost more than every single mainstream media who has a presence on YouTube in New Zealand combined. That's how big and popular my channel is. So, patently wrong. You know how I managed to accomplish that? Not by doing everything for myself, but by going out and selflessly, absolutely selflessly, caring about the activists, caring about these journalists who have their lives threatened, who have their homes taken off them, who have their vehicles stolen, who have been shot at, people who have had their friends murdered, people who have been raped by police in their cells and then called crazy when they try to tell the authorities about it, people who have had their children stolen with child protective services. Nobody is there to help them. Nobody is there to listen to them. And they're all on their own. That was how I felt. I felt all alone. And I found that as soon as I started pledging myself and giving service to others, that is when the feedback loop began. And all of a sudden, sure, everything that I ever needed, this Big Mac computer, 27 inches with a quad-core processor, a $4,000 New Zealand dollar computer, was donated to me by a listener who had never heard of me before and only listened to 15 minutes of one broadcast with my good friend Stuart Swerdlow from expansions.com, who said, Vinny, somebody needs to get you a new Mac. I am so humbled at the position that I am in, that whenever I give something, I get back everything. And that's what they've been trying to teach us. All the old shamans and all the old religious leaders who've been telling you, you don't need a church, you don't need a temple, you don't need a priest or a rabbi. You have the godliness within you, and when you give it out to other people, that is when you ignite the saintly nature of those around you, and their energy becomes spurred on with something that is completely unstoppable. And there is nothing that discourages you from that, so long as you realize the direct implication of your actions. Life is not about serving oneself. I've discovered that life is actually really about, if you serve others, they give back to you more than you could ever possibly give by yourself. You accomplish more together than you can by yourself. That said, if you think that that's the only element and that you don't have to do any work for yourself, you don't have to give yourself time off, or you don't have to give yourself some money or go out and buy a burger or have a few drinks every now and again just to relieve the pressure, you essentially are abdicating your personal responsibility to take care of yourself in favor of just supporting other people, and you will wind up burning out, crashing, and doing absolutely nothing with the rest of your life because you just simply forgot that it's not just about you and it's not just about everybody else. There's a symbiotic relationship. So just like I would, just like I value your guys' show, even though I haven't had much of a chance to listen to really any of the episodes, simply because I know who you are and I know what you do. That is enough for me to recognize the value inherent of what you produce for those people who listen to you. This is why you guys are so important for your audience. I presume you care very much about them, and I presume that you've seen many things that would lead you to understand that all these people who listen to you, all these people who listen to the words of your voice, are under threat. And you're trying to save them. But they must also recognize that it is also time to save yourself. And if you cannot save yourself, help somebody else. Okay, because often through my term doing all this commentary and solving problems and giving platforms to people, I get really burnt out because it's a high-stress high energy, very, like I said, protracted operation. And like any job, people sometimes get weekends off, or they switch off at the end of the day and they come home and what have you. And I've endeavored to do that to myself. My body tells me when it's time to have a break. And after this election cycle, guys, this is, my stress levels have never been higher. My frustration at seeing these lying, psychopathic, scumbaggery individuals financed by banks, telling everybody that they're going to solve all of their problems. Meanwhile, they are the orchestrators of all of those problems in and of themselves. Was such a harsh realization for me that you would see all these people out there waving these flags and supporting these individuals who are doing nothing but implementing policies that are against their interest. So horrific is that experience, so intense is the stress from seeing this happen, that I have to take a week off just so that I can calm down and then come back and hit it 10 times harder. You know, when you come back refreshed from a nice weekend away or something like that? Right, you know, you've got to take care of yourself. And that's what Thanksgiving for me is really going to be about this time.
Well, and look, we understand that, and everyone needs that downtime, and everyone, but for us, this is a cathartic way. I mean, for us, a lot. Look, doing the program provides us with the outlet as well. It's a very cathartic way of handling stress. Believe it or not, I mean, it's heavy, it's deep, but nonetheless, we come back and. We do our program. We share information. We share news. We share analysis. We provide analysis. We provide insight that others may not have. In doing so, we find that we're helping people, and in helping people, that empowers us, and we feel good about that. So, I mean, perhaps to each his own. One would say, but you know, at this point, I have to say this, given our tenuous. Period of time that we're in, given our perilous situation, look at the Middle East. Look at what's happening here in America. Look at what's happening in your country. Look at what's happening in Europe. We have to address these things, and certainly we can do it with levity at times, but it's not levity all the time. Just as it's not not with a 1,000-pound weight on your back. But the bottom line here, I think that we're talking about, is the fact that people tune into our show for specific information. What are they not getting on the evening news? What are they not getting on on normal talk shows? And that's why we exist. And that's why we had asked you to come on and certainly tell your story, and it's a fascinating story, believe me. But are you at this point here? Aside from giving others a platform, are you fighting the fight? Aside from the providing the platform, are you fighting the fight? Are you out there? Obviously, you can't do the research, but are you attempting? Are you doing anything at all to attempt to, for lack of a better word, I don't want to use this word again, but I will anyway, expose what's going on through your show. When you don't have a guest on, what are you talking about, Vinny?
Well, I talk about what my guests have already told me. And here's the thing. I don't do the research personally, but I talk to the people who have done the research. I don't read the books. I interview the author. I don't watch the documentary. I interview the filmmaker. So in essence, my research is lived vicariously through my guests. And when I don't have a guest, I am one of my innate talents is specifically with language. I am a wordsmith. I create words. I'm a lyricist. I write songs, and also I can write. I've written up a number of articles before, and I've written books and short stories and what have you. Language is my key, but the greatest talent that I possess in my field as a radio show host is that of summation. Somebody can talk to me for 2 hours, and I will be able to sum up in minutes what they took 2 hours to express and not leave out a single poignant detail. So when I have time to myself, essentially I'll be unveiling the knowledge of 20 top A-list guests in the space of a 2-hour radio show in a way that is digestible, so that people can learn what others have exposed, and I will give them due credit and say, look, you need to go, if this is of consequence to you, go off and research it. Here's the name of the person. Here is the website, that kind of thing. So in essence, simply out of giving a platform to those who exposed scumbaggery, I expose scumbaggery. You know what I'm saying? If you are the one loading the cannon, and somebody else is aiming it, and somebody else is firing it, everybody who is touching that cannon in any part of the process is killing the enemy. You know what I'm saying?
No, I do. You're a very focused individual. Now, the thing about what we do, and we can go back and forth with this, because I think our efforts are complementary, symbiotic, as you say. I agree with that. Front line, back line, I get that. Doing the research versus, summing it up after interviewing the person who's written the book or done the documentary, I get that as well. We get that as well. Mm. So that's a good thing.
It's about encouragement.
Very much.
I've got so many activists here in New Zealand who've never been on YouTube, never been on radio, and I bring them on my show for the very first time. And what it does is it energizes them, and it encourages them, and it spurs them on, and they go off and they do even more. And oftentimes they'll invite me to their specific protests or doing interviews, and they'll reveal information to me that they don't reveal to anybody else. And then I'm now capable of going out and reporting that, you know? So it's kind of like, I'm not the be-all and end-all. I need others in order to exist. And without me, most people would not be aware that all of these activists exist at all, or at the very least in the New Zealand statute of limitations, because we've got many, many sectors that are currently under attack. I mean, we talked about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. Okay, so essentially that's going to enslave our country and outsource all of our jobs and destroy any semblance of sovereignty that we've got less. That's one issue that I've had half a dozen different guests and activists and people on about. So I can explain in detail what this does. But I'll not only explain that in detail, I can also explain a thing called Compound 1080, which is a virulent poison which was used by the Japanese to poison waterways during World War II in Manchuria in China. And they now are using that and spending about $50 million a year dumping Compound 1080 into pristine New Zealand bushland and water catchment areas, and to a point where this pesticide is getting into the waterways and it can act as an endocrine disruptor as much as being at one part per trillion. And you have people downstream from these big pesticide drops in the middle of the bush who are being born with 3 holes in their penis. Okay, entire communities. There was one community where 9 boys were born with this very, very horrific deformity within weeks after one of these poison drops. So it had manifested very, very quickly in their water table and catchment areas. And then they tell everybody that it's safe and they're trying to protect them from pests and what have you that live in the bush. and you have a look at the police system here in New Zealand and how freaking corrupt they are. And I talked to my friend Grace Hayden, who was a police prosecuting sergeant for 15 years, and she said to me, Vinny, the police are so corrupt in New Zealand that you will, if you're in the police, you will either quit or you will become corrupt. And many things exposed in the police forces here in New Zealand, and we go out and we interview cops. I talk to them all the time, and essentially, one of the most interesting things is when I break stories, but I don't break them knowingly. I don't go out knowing that I'm going to break a story. Something happens to me during the normally a protest or whatever, and it suddenly becomes a breaking story. Like, for instance, we had a 9/11 truth protest, and we were holding it, and we were handing out DVDs and leaflets with information on them. And one of these yellow-suited council working slaves comes up to us and says, "You're not allowed to do that. If you do hand out free information in a democracy, we can now fine you and confiscate your materials and your camera and your megaphones." And we ask the police about this.
Interesting.
And they say, "Sorry, you'll have to take that up with council." So we went to a protest then about a week later after that 9/11 truth protest. And the same council, little jackbooted thug, was there preventing protesters from handing out protest leaflets at a protest with 1,000+ people that was approved by the council. Okay?
No. Insanity. All right. What right did they have to do that? What right did they have?
They had none. And it's completely unlawful what they did. And so I took personal responsibility for noticing and exposing this particular fact. And I set out to the people in the protest, scream out, "If you think this is BS." And everybody screamed out. And everybody kept handing out those leaflets anyway, instead of being afraid of having their stuff confiscated against them. They just gave, democratically, a big finger to tyranny and kept doing the right thing regardless. That's the power that somebody with a megaphone or an amplified voice has. Essentially, it's demagoguery.
Right. But we see, but what you said was key. Everyone was on board being activists themselves, but doing it in a unified manner by saying, "No, we're not going to stop." Basically, if I'm hearing you correctly, no, we're not going to stop. We're going to keep what we're doing, and you did it anyway, and it got done. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Yep.
It was something that
Martin Luther King said, I think, is if when injustice becomes law, resistance becomes duty. And ultimately, that's the main reason why I'm still here, still doing this this radio and videos years on, is because it's my duty. I must do it because nobody else is, essentially.
And even if others start...
I must keep doing it and keep supporting them, much like somebody who's an elder who's experienced in a field must foster and help to grow new talent and new activism. That would be my role in the future. Currently, I'm growing myself and becoming much larger and forming collaborations in an intricate network. And after the shows every day, usually we have a Skype chat with the listeners where we will talk with them and just shoot the breeze, talk about the issues of the day or share their personal stories and just basically have a fun time. And often the guests from the show will join us, and that's ultimately the real show at the end of the day. When you have real people from all sides of the globe all talking to each other in a free flow, unrecorded format, and many people have fostered relationships and friendships with others that they've met in the Vinnie Eastwood social network Skype chats, and particularly those in Australia and New Zealand have kind of like done, have just been living down the road from each other completely unbeknownst, because people who are campaigners for the truth often get ridiculed and ostracized, particularly by family, friends, workplaces, things of that nature, and they feel very underappreciated, and more to the point, they feel very alone. Ultimately, that's one of my major goals, is to make people realize that they are not alone at all. At any one time, you're probably surrounded with people of like minds who really, really care about the issues that you would be a very good friend with. The problem is that many of us choose to withdraw instead of reach out. And that's what I'm trying to do, is actually reach out and pull people in to stop them from withdrawing, to stop them from looking inwards and thinking about themselves all the time, and start looking outwards to see how many different relationships they can spawn and how much of more of a benefit it is to be friends with people who are just as intelligent, just as well informed, and just as happy to fight the new world order and to expose the truth as you are, and it becomes its own reinforcement mechanism.
I love it. I love it. That's exact. I'll tell you what, I was waiting for that. That's exactly the spirit. You've captured the spirit, the inherent spirit. You know, I was talking to someone today. Look, we're not born, we're wired. You, me, everyone listening to this program, we're not wired to be slaves. We're not wired to be subservient to man in the slavery capacity. And you know, it's great to hear. Just great to hear. It's great to know, having had you explain this. You know, your position, your place, your duties, your actions, your scope, your focus, and your intent is a fantastic thing. And I admire that, Vinny. I really do. You've got a fantastic platform, and you're using it very, very adeptly. I admire that.
Well, my mother's boyfriend once told me, Vinny, you're doing God's work. I said, you know what? I probably am.
Well, I think we all are. When we attempt to do, when we're in this venue, this is exactly what we're doing. I hate to do this to you, but I gotta ask your indulgence. I received some flash traffic, at least that's what we call it here, from an intelligence source. He had asked us to cover some breaking news with respect to Benghazi, Libya, and the Middle East, and the connection. Can we terminate our interview a little bit early, but have you on one again in the future?
Oh, that's sad. Because we could actually discuss the Benghazi thing and all of that, because I'm intensely interested in the what's going on in the Middle East now. I mean, if you'd be willing, I'd love to actually stay on and discuss this with you as well.
Yeah, you know what? Then let's do that, because I've got some information here. This is not information that has made it out, and according to this notation I've got, this could rock some foundations of some people. So yeah, in fact, Vinny, we're going to keep you on, and we'll have comments as we break this news on this show. So just hold on. We're going to go to break. When we come back, we're going to do this. Stand by, Vinny. We're talking with Vinny Eastwood from the Vinny Eastwood Show. This is the Agman Report. Today is the 19th day of November 2012, unless you're in New Zealand, at which time you're the 20th.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to this Monday, November 19th, 2012 edition of the Hagman and Hagman Report. We are joined by our special guest, Vinny Eastwood of the Vinny Eastwood out of New Zealand. Before we get into the news, breaking news of this third hour, I just want to let everybody know out there, listener and friend of the show, Angie, we need to pray for her daughter, Shelby.
Oh, yes.
She has some strep throat that's moved to the kidney area, but she's being treated and things are better. And we just ask for your prayers for Shelby. She is 8 years old, never had a health problem in her life, and going through this now. So please keep her in your prayers. Yeah. With that, you have some information you want to hit.
Well, first of all, let's make sure Vinny Eastwood is back with us. Vinny, are you back with us?
Yeah, I'm back
are
with you,
there?
Man.
All right. Vinny, let me ask you out of the gate here. We got to move fast because this information, as far as I'm concerned, is red hot and is important. And this also ties in with going on in the Middle East. Let me ask you a question. What are you in New Zealand? What are you folks hearing about what the heck happened in Benghazi?
Well, what we heard about Benghazi was essentially that, well, a whole bunch of evil Muslims attacked a completely innocent American embassy and basically burned it to the ground and killed three of them, and it's Al-Qaeda-esque, and now we've got to go and invade the Middle East or something. And that's basically the mainstream media side of things, but the information itself is a lot more intense. I mean, people don't know that the Muslim Brotherhood, which is now the leading party in Egypt, was actually founded by the CIA to recruit high-level aficionados, scholars, clerics, business people within the Muslim world so that they could control those who had a primary influence in the region and essentially co-opt them to fulfilling the CIA's function, which was essentially to what they call stabilize the Middle East, which in my opinion means control for the benefit of the West. Same with Hamas in Israel there. Apparently Hamas was started up by Mossad. And incidentally, it's quite funny, isn't it, how you would be foolish enough to fire unguided rockets that are not more than rocket-propelled cherry bombs at the world's fourth largest military, and then be surprised when they respond by giving 400-plus surgical strikes to destroy every bit of people's infrastructure in the Gaza Strip. This is kind of the way things are really, really done, in my opinion. You have a manufactured enemy on both sides, and the only people that come out on the end, on top, are either the United States or Israel. And that's the Middle East story for it in a nutshell from my experience.
Okay. All right. Now, let me ask you one more question on top of this. How does New Zealand, the mainstream New Zealander, look at Obama as a useful idiot, as a fool, as a bumbling idiot, as an incompetent man,
that would be act under the assumption that the general public of New Zealand aren't incompetent bumbling fools themselves, capable of recognizing one if they saw them.
All right.
Let me put it this way. Last year, I saw people driving around with Obama 08 election stickers on their bumpers.
Oh, in New Zealand.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're actually, Joe and I are actually promoting a lot of your national and local candidates as well with bumper stickers. Go figure. All right. Well, here's okay. Now you know more than the average bear out there, but just as a quick recap, here's the information that we have already established, that we've confirmed, reaffirmed six ways, and it's as far as we're concerned verified from sources close. First of all, just some backstory here, real quick. The CIA, in fact, has the. Well, first of all, let me say this. The building where our ambassador, Stevens, was located was not a consulate, was not an embassy. It was, in fact, it's one of the largest, if not the largest, CIA operation centers in the Middle East, in North Africa. That's number one. So every time you hear the word consulate, that's wrong information.
Yeah, on Benghazi. I want to step back just a sec.
Okay.
Just, the whole Arab Spring thing, the way that started,
right?
How what we saw over there, you know, the overthrowing of these governments, the Mubarak's, the Gaddafi's, the secular governments. And then to what Vinny was saying about the two sides, this is us now funding Al-Qaeda.
And Vinny, you're right.
Control of these governments that were once at least somewhat stable and secure, especially in their borders and with the population. And they, the CIA, through a continuity of agenda program through the Bush and Obama administration, planned to invade these Middle Eastern countries. And now we're seeing the ending effects of these. And this Benghazi situation is one of the sad...
well, it's our during, of,
right.
And then you do know, I'm sure you personally know from your guests and what have you, that the United States, the CIA, is running... we were taking the weapons, post-Gaddafi weapons, which included chemical weapons inside Libya, shipping them to Syria by way of Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon. I'm sure you're aware of that.
Mm.
Okay.
What I found really hilarious about the Egypt situation is that you had a whole bunch of people who are starving because their food prices have doubled or tripled under the Mubarak regime, and Mubarak was financed by the CIA, and he trained the military to support almost exclusively the president. And so when the revolutionaries, in quotation marks, of course, overthrew their brutal dictator, they then got a military dictatorship, which then got into a Muslim Brotherhood dictatorship, who were controlled by the CIA anyway. You know?
Exactly.
What have you accomplished?
Well, perpetual warfare is what you've accomplished.
And the other element is the Benghazi thing. What I've saw from the footage, now, I've been to hundreds of protests, guys, hundreds, and not one protest that I've been to has there been no cops. When I was seeing the footage from that alleged consulate, there was not a single cop protecting it from this huge swath of very angry looking protesters. And I thought to myself, that's not an accident that they've got a whole bunch of angry people out there and the cops are not there to police them in any way, shape or form. Essentially, they're saying, come on, get them.
Well, let me ask you, Vinny. New Zealand, have you seen the movie The Old Knight from the 1970s? This movie, The Godfather. Are you familiar with that?
Well, yes, and I do a very good impression, even if I do say so myself.
Oh, you're killing me, man, with these impressions. Between your accent and your impressions, what I just heard was no, never mind. Just kidding. No, you're good. I got to tell you, that's why you didn't see any cops, because it was a mob operation, basically, a spy versus spy type operation going on here. The police were in on it, which is why this Turkish consul general visited Stevens and was left without being molested by any official police force. The police were there. They were blocking off the roads so the protesters, in quotation marks, could do their dirty work. So they were running the security for the protesters, okay? But here's the information, without keeping people in suspense. Here's the brand new information. The Iranian component in this, we had, now Iran figures prominently here, as does Saudi Arabia. But there's this global chess game going on, as you well know. But here's the information that is new and hopefully will come out. The darker, even darker side to this, if you can believe this, there is a drug component to this. Not only is there a weapons running operation going out of Libya into, you know, up north, but there is a drug component that's coming west, going through Libya into Europe. Now, originating from Central and South America, and specifically Venezuela, and who is at the helm of this, but our own CIA. Okay, now throw the drug trafficking into the mix here, going out of South and Central America, going through North Africa up into Europe, especially also the drugs from Mexico we got going here. This is a huge moneymaker. Involved in this is a guy from Syria, actually two brothers from Syria, they were born in Libya, live in Venezuela, but are acting, one is the ambassador to Syria from Libya. So it's an incredible situation. These are the guys running the drugs. But in exchange, not all of the weapons are going up into Syria via Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon. Some of the weapons are making their way back to Central America. And this is the other part of the news I just received. Some of the other weapons are making their way back here into Central America, Mexico, for use, ultimately, for a potential false flag type operation, or one could call it that, in the United States. In other words, a Benghazi in the heartland or in the interior of the United States, or a Mumbai-style attack in the heartland or inside the borders of the United States because of these weapons flow from northern Africa. So not all the weapons are going north. They're going west while the drugs are going the other way. So this is the information. And throw this into the mix, the weapons are Iranian weapons. We've got a porous open border on our southern border between the United States and Mexico. They know this. People know this. And there are weapons and drugs going across the border both directions. It's just but here's the thing. Right now, we are fighting an asymmetrical war right now, or an asymmetrical war is being fought. At one side is Russia with their idea of this one world, new world order, or globalist agenda, communism, actually, who's got, there's a little brother, Iran, who's actually doing, providing the men and materiel for the fighting, while Saudi Arabia is providing the money, and the CIA is providing the direction. Have I lost you yet? Or you got it, Vinny, right? I mean,
it sounds like Iran-Contra scandal where the U.S. was shipping the guns in and the drugs out hadn't stopped anywhere. Still going on today?
Absolutely. Quick study. Very good. You absolutely. This is exactly what it is. Think Iran-Contra, but in a much larger and much worse scale, because now we're dealing with gas, chemical weapons, that are Iranian made, but with the knowledge and even the assistance of people in high levels of government are going to be allowed to make it not only to Syria, but look, we know according to the information I've got today, that we know that some chemical weapons are in Mexico waiting, if they have not already made their way into the United States. Now, what the heck would that do to the United States? Well, obviously, what's the end goal here? Tyranny and brown shirts.
And the only way Hitler was able to bring around to his tyranny and brown shirts was with false flag operations. There's two in particular that I can point to, the first being the Reichstag, where they burned down their entire parliament, Hitler's SS, burned it down, blamed it on some, mentally handicapped individual, and said that this one guy by himself with a single gas can managed to burn down an entire parliament building single-handed without anybody being able to stop him. And sure enough, because they were lying so massively, everybody believed it. And then they dressed up a whole bunch of German soldiers in Polish soldier uniforms, Poland being one of the weakest armies in Europe at the time, and then attacked one of their own radar stations and said, "Oh, these really evil, dangerous, incredibly powerful weapons of mass destruction /quote-unquote bearing Polish people have attacked us. Now we must retaliate." Does that sound familiar to anybody? How something huge goes up in smoke, and then you've apparently been attacked by some outside enemy that actually has no real capacity to defend themselves or even attack you, and then send your people halfway around the world to attack them, and then starting up the Department of Homeland Security in order to make sure the fatherland is protected. Any of this ringing a bell?
I'm going to tell you, it's amazing to have. Let me ask you: can we not learn from him? I mean, have we not learned from history? Has the American, the world population been dumbed down, Vinny?
Well, actually, a more poignant question: have we been taught any real history at all?
Ah, that's a good point. That's a very good point. I mean, look, we've got right now Obama. If you look at our dear leader, or the alleged leader of this country, Obama has ties three ways, four ways to Karl Marx. I mean, as a communist, I mean, he's got the Clintons, who are in power, really never left power, have ties to Antonio Gramsci, the schooling, the European neo-Marxist philosopher, and of course. He's got their ties there to Saul Alinsky, and Saul Alinsky has got Obama's tied to Saul Alinsky in terms of that type of breeding and or that type of ideology. So what we've got here,
was not one of his mentors as well, also Zbigniew Brzezinski, the author of The Grand Chessboard.
Absolutely, and that is Joe's department.
Yeah, I've done a lot of research on that guy. I've read almost every one of his books.
Vinny, what do you know about Brzezinski? I mean, help us understand that guy.
Well, people call him the big new Brzezinski. I call him the little old Brzezinski because he's basically the little old globalist think tanker kind of sociopathic intellectual who has over many, many years in various positions of the U.S. administration and globalist organizations such as the Trilateral Commission, Bilderberg Group, the Council on Foreign Relations, essentially has fostered a movement of people within the United States administration who have been influenced directly in the ways of the destruction of anything truly idealistically American in order to, ironically enough, save America and its dominance in through to the 21st century. Ironically, in order to save America, you must destroy it. It seems very similar to the Council of the 33rd Degree of Freemasonry and their main tagline, Ordo ab Chao, otherwise meaning order out of chaos. In order to create, you must first destroy. And that's essentially the role I feel that Brzezinski plays in the United States, is to create these political candidates, or at least in large part, play a massive role, whether that be directly in their cabinets or through their influencing in their earlier careers, in order to get them to be the main instruments of destruction of the American way of life, so that he can have what he's always cherished and always wished for, a global tyranny called the New World Order.
Is the reach of Brzezinski in New Zealand? I mean,
If Brzezinski is one of the prime influences of the governments of the United States, the more poignant question was, does the United States have influence in New Zealand? Let me tell you who the current prime minister of New Zealand is. His name is John Key, and for 2 years he worked as Merrill Lynch's representative on the board of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, in charge of European bond and derivatives trade.
Wow. Small world, isn't it?
No. It's a large world, but it's controlled by a small bunch of world leaders who do not lead. They stamp us down. And you have a look at the cabinet. You would have a look at, say, for example, the opposition. You would expect that maybe, if you had one candidate in your position who's a globalist through and through, who is pushing world trade deals, who signed us up to NATO over the weekend, okay? This happened about 8 weeks ago. John Key comes back and he says, hey, we're now a member of NATO. Hold on a second. Aren't we a South Pacific nation? What part of the South Pacific is part of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization at all? Huh? It's because it's the global army. That's what it is. And we are now dredging our main Auckland Harbour to get bigger ships in. Currently, we're able to support the largest cruise liners pretty much in the world. Can I ask you, what is larger than the largest cruise liner in the world? there's only one kind of vessel that comes to mind. Aircraft carriers.
That's right.
I think we are turning into a military outpost, and I believe that the globalists have sent their agents here to destroy this country. And they are doing a fracking fine job at it, gentlemen.
Did you sign up for that? Of course not. Did the people of New Zealand sign up for it? Of course not. Is there any revolt? No, I don't hear any, I don't think. Just like America, right?
That's exactly right. And it's because of the fact that we've all got the exact same tyranny that expresses itself in the exact same ways that it is obviously a conspiracy. If it wasn't a conspiracy, there would be some difference from country to country, but there is none.
No, you're exactly right. I mean, you've got
same tactics, the way that they, put one agenda on paper, implement it. When you call them out on it, they, you know, play with the definitions and their meanings of those words, and it's a play on words. The news runs with it, reiterates it over and over again until the people who aren't paying attention enough believe it, and believe it is in their best interest. And this is where we have the next generation here in America of people who are going to be handing over their guns if Obama has his way.
Yeah, what's the gun policy there in New Zealand, Vinny?
Pardon?
What's the gun policy? Private gun
ownership? Oh, you're going to love this, gentlemen. It is illegal to pop a clip into your gun in your own home if it has more than if it has more than 10 bullets in the clip.
All right.
It is illegal to have a hot weapon inside your home. If you leave your gun in your car to run inside to a convenience store to get a packet of chips, and you come out and there's a cop next to your car, he will say that you've had an unattended weapon, and you will have your gun license taken off you. If you want a handgun, you have to attend 12 training sessions per year just to keep your license. So you have to come to a firing range every single month and sign in and log in, and you have to register, and there's no such thing as concealed carry. You have to have a 100% legal purpose for carrying your firearms around anywhere. Like, which means basically, if you've got any kind of weapon on you that fires projectiles, you are either A1 on your way hunting, and you'll have to show hunting permits and what have you to prove that to that effect, or you're B2 going to a shooting range. There is no other ways that you can use weapons in this country. You can't. You do not have the right to bear arms. It is ridiculously difficult to get a assault weapon license, or even a semi-automatic weapon license, or a handgun license. Virtually impossible. You have to have such a clean record and such a clean slate and what have you. And those rights that you've been gotten can be taken away from you so quickly it'll make your head spin. If they don't like what you're doing, in order to have any form of rifle that carries, I think it's illegal to have any more than 10 bullets for a clip. Okay.
Wow.
And if you have any such weapons who can take up to 10 or less bullets, you have to have a safe in your house that is bolted to the floor and the wall. Okay, which means how many people in rented accommodation do you think are ever going to get their hands on a weapon like that if they have to clear with their landlord for to bolt a safe into the wall and the floor? It ain't going to happen.
No.
Be that as it may, we've got an enormous amount of firearms here, almost as much per capita as they do in perhaps Canada. And in my opinion, we need something in this country on par with the Second Amendment. And I've spoken to many socialists around here who are big gun grabbers and UN lovers and all of these types of assorted trash. And their point is, there's no real reason why you would ever have an automatic weapon. There's no legal purpose. Why would you have such a thing? And I say, here's the reason why, mate. Every single country that has had a complete gun ban on any type of weapon that is military grade has had their population subsequently enslaved and exterminated. Not enslaved or exterminated, but enslaved and exterminated. Here's the lawful purpose for having a firearm that can have 30 rounds in a clip that I can take out 30 soldiers with if I'm a crack shot from a mile away with a 50 caliber scope. The government will kill me unless I can kill them first, if they choose to come after me. If I'm, on the other hand, armed and the government isn't after me, unless I've shot somebody who's innocent, there shouldn't be any reason for the government to interfere with my right to bear arms. It's as simple as that. You keep arms on you to prevent yourself from getting exterminated if a government turns tyrannical. Same principle as a condom. It's better to have it and not need it than need it and not have it.
Well, Vinny, how was the evolution of your gun laws? I mean,
well, you know how there was a Columbine shooting, yes. and all of a sudden after that, Oklahoma City. And you have all of these different gun-related crime sprees and what have you from people that were on Prozac or were conducted by the government themselves, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah, we had a couple of those incidents here. And one man down in a town down in the South Island killed, I think, 14 or 16 people with some assault weapons that he had. And the police didn't come and try to stop him, or at least only the local police officer did. He got shot, and the SWAT team didn't turn up until afterwards. Some say it was deliberate. But that one incident of one crazy person using his weapons, going out and killing people, is suddenly a good reason why all of the other hundreds of thousands of gun owners in this country, who never hurt anybody, who never shot anybody, suddenly all now have to have incredibly unreasonable and draconian gun legislation that prevents them from freely practicing just the simple practice of gun ownership.
So this evolved then rather recently in terms, I mean, relatively recently?
No. This happened almost 2 decades ago. And guns have been gradually demonized. Like, I'm sure that you've had ads in the United States that are probably UN or NGO sponsored that will say, prevent handgun crime, ban them now, ban them. But they don't mention that in many cases in New Zealand, the production of a weapon during the commission of a crime often stops that crime being committed. Okay, somebody comes up to you with a baseball bat, okay, and he's threatening your wife and children. You pull a handgun on him. In New Zealand, that's illegal, and you will go to jail for defending yourself. You know the old saying that a man's home is his castle, that if somebody busts into your house and they're holding a knife against your wife's throat and what have you?
Sure.
In New Zealand, if you pull a gun on that person that's holding a knife to your wife's throat, that's illegal, and you will go to jail, not the man who is actually holding your wife hostage. Okay, it's about comparative force in this country. If somebody's attacking you with a knife, you must defend yourself with a knife. You can't just simply pull out a gun. Is that not insane?
I mean look, in some areas, in some states, look where we live. There was the furthest wall doctrine, for example, where if somebody broke into your house, even if you had a gun, the measurement of resistance, you would have to retreat to the furthest wall, hence the name, before you can actually fire and shoot the person. Otherwise, you could be charged and held liable for the death of that person. But that in the area where we live has been changed. But in other areas, as you well know, New York State, New York City, a lot of these urban areas have their own specific gun rules, gun laws. So, yeah, so it's interesting because, well, you know, we are looking, Vinny, at the go ahead.
Well, each time those gun bans have been implemented, either in New York City or in Washington, D.C., the murder rate shoots right up, so to speak, massively.
Oh, absolutely.
Because it is only the law-abiding citizens who obey that gun ban law. And so now those who were once law-abiding and had the capacity to defend themselves no longer have the ability to defend themselves. And those criminals who use those weapons for bad reasons and to attack other people still have those weapons because they still don't obey the laws.
No, of course not.
No, Obama here, they're drafting and floating this idea around through the ATF, that drafting legislation for banning semi-automatic rifles, shotguns, handguns, and also high-capacity magazines, rifles, and shotguns with pistol grips, not only to make them illegal to sell them, your guns and your magazines, but also to leave them behind in your will. This is Dianne Feinstein.
One of our luminary elites. Yeah, Vinny, I mean, you're knowledgeable about the United Nations and about the architecture here. I mean, where are we going here? We're on the precipice right now of a third world war, where the end result is going to be I mean, in Syria alone, if Assad is toppled, a couple of the experts on Syria, for example, look, there's 40,000 dead right now because of the internal strife caused by the external influence in Syria. If Assad topples, they said 40 million will be the death toll. But on the larger scale, are we not looking at the culling of the global population here?
Well, we're talking about the United Nations, and many people don't know much about the United Nations. Many people don't know that its very first Secretary General was a former Nazi Party official under Adolf Hitler during the Second World War. Many people do not know that the building, the UN building, and the land that it is on was donated by none other than John D. Rockefeller. Okay? So, let me get this straight. Somebody that's supposed to be the peaceful, loving, kind and caring organization that helps everybody get along is headed by a Nazi and funded and supported by people who also funded the Nazis during World War II. And this is supposed to be our loving world government that we're getting. Does anybody else see a conflict of interest here? Or seeing that the checkerboard just is stacked perhaps in the other person's favor? You know, and then surprisingly, they come out with things like Codex Alimentarius. Oh, we need to ban all food that's freely grown in people's backyards. We need to ban people from being able to catch water. We need to force people off the land by allowing GMOs and things like that to float onto their farms, and then send our little Monsanto agents on there to confiscate said farms because, hey, they've got our GMOs. They must have stolen them. Let's force everybody off the land under Agenda 21, herd them into cities, completely disarm them, and completely erode any sovereignty that any nation has, as well as completely and utterly banning small arms, so that that population will not only be able to feed themselves, won't be able to hold them, won't be able to house themselves, won't be able to defend themselves. They won't be able to do anything except do precisely what the armed and very, very draconian world government wants them to do, including get on a cattle car and be exterminated.
Absolutely, 100%. How soon? We're connected with intelligence people within the intelligence community, the people who are God-fearing men who are seeing what's taking place and don't like it. And I ask them the same question I'm about to ask you. How soon do you see things taking place here? I mean, I'm not asking for a date and time or a month even, or even a year. But, I mean, how close are we to a total capitulation to a global governance, in your estimation?
I think we already have. Every single one of us. If there was not total capitulation, then all of these pieces of legislation would have resistance against them. They'd be getting overthrown. The fact is, we already live under a world government. We have been for some time. In the United States, they've been living under a world government since 1914 with the institution of the Federal Reserve Act. In New Zealand, we've been living under a world government since 1963 with the New Zealand Reserve Bank Act. In England, they've been living under a world government since the Battle of Waterloo, when Rothschild bought out the Bank of England, and suddenly he was the money man for all of them. As soon as the elite control your money supply and the issuance of your currency, you're part of the globalist system. It's as simple as that. What the question is, and I think what you're really trying to get at, is when is it going to hot up? When are they going to implement this entire agenda? When are they going to start exterminating everybody, kill everybody, destroy the economy, and destroy sovereignty? And
yes.
I think that it's sort of like the truth movement, as it's loosely termed, in my opinion, as somebody who's in the truth for the truth's sake, but the whole point of the truth movement is to reveal what's really going on, and that's ultimately it. These things can only go on while they remain in the shadows, out of the light of day. So, it's like we in the quote-unquote truth movement and they in the quote-unquote globalist cartel are running a race against each other. We're going 100 miles an hour, and we're starting 50 miles up the track. They're going 50 miles an hour, and they're starting at the beginning or whatever. So, I don't know, but I've heard a lot of people say that there's going to be this mass arrest, or that suddenly these globalists are all going to go to prison or be overthrown, or there will be mass protests, the 99%, we are the 99%, etc. None of them seem to have produced any fruit. So regardless of how positive or how negative somebody's assessment of the current situation is, I think it's irrelevant at what point they would implement all of these agendas, because it means that regardless, one must fight today and tomorrow and every day until they do. If you still have air in your lungs, you must be screaming the truth out as often as humanly possible, so that there was at least a chance that we may overthrow these people. Tyrannies always fail. That is what the lesson of history is, and is always, always either overthrown or brought about by a small, determined minority who refuse to give in, who work tirelessly day after day to accomplish their goals. The globalists play their games. We play ours.
Well said. Very well said. I got to tell you. See, I'm astounded in a way, because a conversation I had earlier with a source from the intelligence community, I said, how soon, you know, are we looking here at really kind of a shooting war, if you will? I mean, you know, what's going to be, you know, give me like an idea of the course of events. Ultimately, bang, we're going to have a currency collapse. The dollar, U.S. dollar, is going to collapse. And when that does, what's it going to do to your form of currency in New Zealand? I mean, obviously, you're going to have it's going to have a massive effect on you as well.
I believe that the dollar collapse is one of these things that they will implement so that people will accept a new global currency. We talked with the former finance minister of New Zealand, David Cunliffe, I think, and he said that in the very near future, we may see the emergence of a number of different currencies, and I'm betting that the globalist banksters will simply emerge as the controllers and issuers of said currencies. SDRs, for example, special drawing rights. I've had Pastor Lindsay Williams on my show a number of times, and what he's saying is that the more recent QE3, I think they're calling it, where they're purchasing $40 billion a month of mortgage-backed securities with the Fed, is going to push the United States currency into hyperinflation within a number of months. $40 billion is too big a number for anybody to even comprehend. You know, nobody who's listening to this broadcast has $40 billion bucks in the bank, do you? So you've got no comprehension of how much money that is.
I haven't checked my bank account recently. No, you're right, though. No, exactly. It's beyond comprehension.
Okay, so
it really is.
So they're making more money than it's beyond comprehension. Now, beyond that, they're going to expand that money supply using fractional reserve, which has an unlimited amount of expansion. So it's $40 billion times infinity, which they're then going to put into the derivatives market, where you call $1 $40 and then gamble it on the stock market at 1,000 to 1. So you've got $40 billion times infinity, gambled at 1,000 to 1, that's called $40.
Uh-huh.
Do you think that a currency is going to survive such a thing? It's not. So the certainty is that it will collapse. The timing, on the other hand, I believe that in the globalist mindset, timing is everything. These people have got it down, and they always have these specific dates throughout history when big events will happen. And it's kind of like this occult ritual and Kabbalah that they seem to follow. So it may happen on one of those particular dates, or we may see the emergence of a secession movement, globally speaking. And currently the United States, I believe Texas, has received 25,000 signatures, which means that the Correct. White House will have to view their request for secession from the Union. And many, many other states, I believe close to 30 or states, I think, are also putting in similar petitions but have yet to gain the amount of signatures. Now, Americans are very, very interesting people, if you don't mind me saying. Number one, there's some of the most generous and caring and loving people. Number two, there's a difference between the American people and the American government. The American government will see a threat and go out and kill that threat. The American people will see a threat and walk away from it and not feed it and allow it to die. And I believe that's what the states should do, and allow the federal government in its current tyrannical form to simply bleed out like a stuck pig.
Perfect, because the secession movement, in order for that to succeed, and I mean be successful, is for the states, for the people of the states and the states themselves to stop feeding the beast. That's the only way that this is going to work. And unfortunately, the beast is the federal income tax system, which finances everything, and people are deathly afraid of that.
Yeah, I mean, they have the power, if you don't comply, to take your things from you.
But at the end of the day, that's what we need to do. We need to unite and do that. And hopefully, as you've so aptly pointed out there, you know, this movement, hopefully it takes hold, and that's what does take place. But you know, we have to stop feeding the beast, and that's an important fact. But go ahead.
Well, Americans are not alone in this fight. Wherever you are on this earth today, you are under the jackboot of the globalist UN. It's as simple as that. Their leaders and banking cartel scum are currently in charge of your country, whether you realize it or not. And this means that if America falls, so does the rest of the world. Okay? It is the last bastion, I believe, of hope for a new renaissance for humanity. And that's why I pledge really regularly to never, ever let you guys just kind of go, oh, it's all your fault, it's all your problem. Hell no. I'm here to help, and I will not stop, and you have allies everywhere. Because the worst thing that you can ever have in any military conflict is nobody who's got your back, right? Now, there's two tactics, two tactics and analogies that I like to apply here. Firstly is the tactic of a cactus. A cactus protects itself by covering itself in spines from every direction, so that any time that any creature comes up and tries to destroy it or attack it, it gets a little prick to remind him. This is how the truth movement is now working. You've got truthers like me popping up in New Zealand, truthers like you popping up in America, people in England and India, and I've had people on the show from Tunisia and all over the world, essentially. People are naturally creating this tactic of a cactus because for each conspiracy, for each part of the area of the world, I can guarantee you there is one person who is that little spine that is sticking out and showing them that we're not going to go without a fight. And the second is about tactically turning it into a media game, because as Alex Jones illustrates, it's an information war. And when you talk about war, you've got to talk about military tactique and relay it with creative analogy to the media. So my one is a phalanx. In Greek a battle formation, particularly made famous by Alexander the Great, they had a shield formation called a phalanx. You had a large shield that was capable of covering thigh to neck, Okay, that is how big the shield was, namely because that's where the femoral artery all the way to your trachea and any kill shots that could be come at you with either a sword or a spear would be able to be deflected. But the point being, not to protect yourself with that large shield, but actually to protect the man next to you. And you'll notice that most of the major and military armies in the world, that's actually what they teach their soldiers. It's not about protecting yourself. It's about the men. It's about the man next to you. So what you do is you've created a shielding mechanism that also protects you from behind as well as the man next to you from the front. You don't have to worry about defending yourself anymore. So what I talked about is an activist phalanx, because these are the death blows that we can be struck. Our radio shows could go off air. Our funding could be cut from our listeners or something of that nature. The currency could collapse. We could run out of food. We could be kicked out of our house. There's all these certain things that would essentially deal a death blow to our operations to try and free a greater humanity. And so when we talk about our radio personalities and YouTubers and all of this kind of stuff, adopt the tactic of the phalanx. If you know of any other person out there who is really hurting right now, who needs help, step in to defend them in any capacity or way that you can. We all stand together and protect the man next to us, or there is nobody watching our back, and we will all die and hang separate.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what
perfectly said.
Yeah.
And if just every person in this world would have that attitude and mentality, we would be in a much better place. But unfortunately, we have a not even an American culture anymore, but a world culture of selfishness. And as you alluded to earlier, the best thing you can do for yourself is to give as much of yourself to other people as possible. And those rewards are so much better than doing for yourself. And if we could have a humanity that was selfless, we could truly break this tyranny instantly.
Well, I don't think it's about the masses. I don't think any time throughout history have the masses really made a difference. The American Revolution was fought by not more than 4%, 3% of the U.S. population who were willing to lay down their lives to die against the tyranny of King George. Okay? 3%.
Right.
That's all it took. In communist China, Chairman Mao, regardless of whether how evil the communist regime may have been, they managed to take over their country with 1% popular support. The Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, 4% popular support. You don't need the masses. The masses have never made a difference. Never. It is the small, determined minority and the individual spirit that has always and will always be the deciding factor. So, if anything, you need to tell the masses that they're not masses anymore. They are individuals, and they must make decisions and take action themselves, or they will never make a difference.
Beautifully well said. Vinny, I'll tell you what. What a way to end the program. Well said. I could not have articulated that better. And Joe is just nodding over here saying, absolutely. We now have to accept the responsibility, understand the instant and total threat to our survival, to the survival of our kids, our offspring, our grandchildren. We're at that precipice right now. We're at that juncture right now.
Yeah. Well, we want to thank you for being on our show. I want to thank your producer, Mitch, for setting this up. And it was a blast being on your show, and definitely enjoyed you being here. And we got to stay in contact, stick together, and definitely do this again.
You are on. You are on our team. We're teammates, I guess. Comrades in arms, shall we say?
Or to use a more clandestine phrase, we're collaborators.
There you go. There you go. Very good.
Well, thanks, Vinny, from the Vinny Eastwood Show.
My friend, God bless, man. Thank you. Yeah, Joe.
Thanks, gentlemen.
Yeah, and take it easy, Vinny.
60 seconds.
Well,
and folks, you can join us.
I could take it easy, but I wouldn't accomplish as much.
Well, keep stirring up the trouble.
There you go. There you go. Folks, that'll do it for another night of the Hagman Report for this Monday, November 19th, 2012. I'm Doug Hagman with me and Joe Hagman. We're signing off, and I'll tell you what, we'll be back tomorrow, strong as ever. Don't forget, we're going to be live on Thursday.
And Friday.
Until tomorrow, God bless. Stay safe.